Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Game Dev London podcast. So, my name is Adam, you can refer to me as he, him, and with me today on this pink evening, apparently, I have our wonderful co-host, Vix Woodford. Vix, hi, how are you? How are you doing today?
Hi, I'm okay. I'm also in a weirdly pink room.
I mean, so I did this for the last episode because I was like, I probably should have something going on, then it's just blank, blank, blank. And it does feel very streamery. I feel like I should be on Twitch right now, and it's got that kind of energy. I don't have the, you know, the leaves, what they're called? Bio leaves? You know, the light, the leaves shaped lights you get on walls. Yeah. Don't have those.
I quite like those, though.
They're so expensive. I do want them, but they're very cool.
Yeah, I've just got £20 like Amazon ring light and... I also have
mine's like a 10-20 quid Amazon ring light. So if you feel like we have a really professional setup here, it's all just secret Amazon purchases. It's okay. It's fine. Or there are other retailers are also available, but that's where we got. We have come together today to have a chat about something really important to games and also to VR, because we're both VR developers, so we're going to dive into a bit of that as well. We're going to chat about onboarding. We're going to talk about onboarding in video games as standard, onboarding in VR games specifically, why they're different, why does that difference matters, how they can work together to improve onboarding across the board. Before we sort of dive headfirst into that, I do want to talk about what is onboarding. So just to give a quick example to people who are out there. So onboarding is basically the process of when you start something, and it's not just games, this exists in the real world. So when you start a new job, when you start, you buy a piece of equipment, when you install a microwave or whatever it might be, onboarding is the process of getting you from not knowing anything about it, not understanding it, not knowing what it is, to being on board with how that thing works. So if it was a microwave, you read the instruction manual, you get an idea of what it is. Normally onboarding is a bit more involved. It normally involves you being taken through steps, either by someone or in some kind of way that they step you through the moments of what's involved. But it's the idea of getting you on board with the ideas, the processes, the setup, the systems, whatever is involved in kind of doing that kind of thing. So this happens in games and in VR. Very generally, it's level one, something that brings you into the game. Sometimes it might introduce the story. Sometimes it just introduces the mechanic. Sometimes it's very obvious. Sometimes it's not very obvious at all, but it's still there. And sometimes it's just missing. And sometimes it's terrible. And we're going to talk about all of that today. But to start off with, I think it probably makes sense. Let's start with some of our favorite examples of onboarding in games. So Vix, thinking back on those many, many years of wonderful and terrible games, in equal measure, have you got any examples of onboarding that you particularly enjoyed or you thought worked particularly well?
Well, I was thinking about it, and I think, for one, Skyrim does it really well. And Skyrim's a game that, you know, everyone's played about 5 times on about 20 different consoles. I've even played it on my Alexa, which was an interesting experience, because it's just a text-based adventure and it's wonderful. They're frankly, really, really nice. But the way that Skyrim onboards you is just giving you the text prompts, but not giving them to you until you actively need them. So it's not overloading you with information. It's just putting you in a situation and then telling you what to do in that situation. And I quite enjoy when games do that versus just, you know, giving you everything at once.
Mm-hmm. Bethesda games in particular, they go for this kind of approach of you feel like the game has started, but actually the game hasn't started until about 5 minutes in at or 5 to 1 hour in, depending on which game you're playing, where they've suddenly set up everything that you need to know to then play the game. Skyrim, it's got a particularly good sort of introduction, like, these are the factions, here's the story, this is a dragon, there you go, enjoy. Yeah. And then just lets you loose. Whereas Fallout 3 and Fallout 4 both kind of set you up in this kind of, okay, this is the world within which you find yourself, you're introduced to moving and existing and shooting and being and all this kind of stuff. Particularly Fallout 3, where you start the game as basically a baby.
Literally
a baby.
The first moments of the game, you are born into the world.
And you go through the stages. As you're growing up in that, you're introduced to all the mechanics of the game through the child of the child. So, like, shooting is shooting a BB gun and some bottle caps. Mm. Your birthday, you're introduced to the stats system and all those kind of things. So by the time you leave the vault, it's a literal physical representation of onboarding you into the world. You are ready to go in and do whatever and understand all the mechanics. So go on.
I think it's quite interesting because that's something that Bethesda do in pretty much every game that they develop, is they have this setup stage where you basically are locked into a linear path, and that's their onboarding for you. Is you Oblivion, for example, you start off in prison and then you go through the tunnels to escape from the prison, all the story stuff happens, and you're suddenly out into the world and you can do whatever you want.
And it's interesting because I've seen games do, in fact, one game comes to mind on that because it started the other way, where it just went, here you go, enjoy. Had a couple of things, which was Rocket League, which started very much kind of like, you can play casual matches or you can play kind of, they had some training modes where they sort of introduced, you know, try and block this, try and move it, but at no point did they originally introduce the mechanics of the game. So you just kind of go in, you hit, press all the buttons, go read the control scheme, very kind of lacking onboarding it. And only now, sort of since they went, certainly since they went free to play, maybe just before that, did they introduce a linear onboarding setup where you're presented, when you first start the game on a new device, it sort of presents this kind of, as though you're in a match, but everything is hotkeyed. So it's like, now jump, yeah, now press this, which is great for people who haven't played the game, because then you go, you just get that little bit of understanding. So when you start your first match, you're not going in completely blind. You do have an understanding of what's happening. But it also, it locks, every time you start on a new console, it locks you in. So if you have an obscene number of hours in Rocket League, like I do, every time I start a new device, like if I'm like, oh, you know, I don't want to try on the Switch, or oh, I'm at someone's house and they haven't got it, so I'll play it on that, I have to play 5 minutes of linear onboarding. And that's an interesting part of it, is that sometimes there's a sense of they have to teach you the rules in all these kind of games. You have to learn what you're doing. But a lot of onboarding can be very, very linear in that sense. And it doesn't gauge, do you get it? Have you understood it? They force you down a path of, we assume you know zero and we'll teach you everything, which means that if you do understand what you're doing, that could be quite harsh.
Yeah, it's sort of where linear and like intuitive gameplay, I should say, differs from, say, tutorials. So intuitive gameplay is like, you know, your Oblivion, your Fallout, that's sort of intuitive. Okay, now I know that I need to do this because there's a bear coming at me, I should probably kill it. Versus something that may need to be guided, like Rocket League, where if you're a new player, you're going to sit down at your PC and go, oh, I have no idea what I'm doing. And to be fair, I still have no idea what I'm doing. And I've got a decent amount of hours in Rocket League. Can't fly. But yeah, there's no tutorial for that.
Well, and I mean, this is the thing about the difference between sort of going through something that is, you know, it's just teaching you the basics, teaching you the rules and that kind of thing, to something where you have to fundamentally understand the mechanics of the game to improve. Like, for example, another good example of that is Mario Odyssey, where it will, at every stage where you have to learn something new, a kind of mechanic, whether it's a jump or a dive or whatever, present you with the perfect scenario where you have to have done it to move forward. Nintendo being just kind of those masters of onboarding as well as game design in general. But what Odyssey doesn't do is it doesn't teach you how you can combine those different movesets to then do amazing things. So the big trick on Odyssey, kind of spoilers, is that the more you can utilize different mechanics together, so you can do a jump, a dive, a hat throw, a dive onto the hat, a bounce off, the further and further you can get distance with your movement and your jump, and get moons that are quite hard to reach or get to out of reach places. But the game doesn't teach you that. It doesn't teach you about combining those moves. That's the game. That's what you have to go away and learn and figure out. And the same with Breath of the Wild, you know, you're taught the mechanics, you're not taught the synergies and the combination. That's the exploration phase. That's for you to go and learn and figure out and become better at the game of doing it. Same with Rocket League. Whereas, and another game that does that, but and again, a very hardcore anyway, is Splitgate. Obviously, super successful at the minute. Most people understand Halo, most people understand Portal, but it still takes you very, very, very linear, walk from A to B. Now walk from A to B, but jump over the gaps. Now walk from A to B and shoot a portal at the end of it. Now walk through this portal and da-da-da-da. And it's very linear, but because the game is very dependent on you need to understand these basics, it's only about 5 minutes, and it does go, here are the basics, here you go, you've got it, great, move on. And that is okay, although it's not intuitive, it's not, you know, we'd all love to have some sort of crazy, like, introductory shorthand, like, wow, introduced to the lore, all this kind of thing, Skyrim style. But it doesn't happen all the time. And what could be worse than that is onboarding that can set you down the wrong path. So have you had any examples of where you've done bad onboarding and really been put in a position where you're like, ooh, I didn't enjoy this?
So I just dislike it when I'm given all the information at once. So you are presented with like a key binding map, and then I think an example of it would probably be No Man's Sky back in the day.
Yes, that's a very good example.
Very, very, very unintuitive onboarding. Probably some of the worst I've come across, because it literally just goes, here's every game mechanic, here's your goal, go. And it's a lot of information to absorb, and it wasn't put in a very friendly format. Me having ADHD, I don't get along well with like lists of things to read. So things like... Sorry, the ice cream van came around and I'm really distracted.
A very good example of the point that you were making. Ice cream fans are distracting. But, I mean, I'm 100% with you on No Man's Sky. I remember one of the very first times we played No Man's Sky, back in 2017, I think it was, I spawned in on a cold planet that was immediately trying to kill me and just told, you need to find this thing. It's somewhere. And you spend, you know, the beginning of the game. This is then, not now, by the way. You spend the beginning of the game trying to figure out, okay, I need to figure out how to survive. I'm constantly dying. This is on the easier mode as well. I'm constantly dying. I don't know what I'm trying to find. Am I even going to make it before my character is dead? I don't know if that's possible. What happens then? Oh, you get reset back to where you started. Wonderful. I still don't know what I'm doing. And it had the capacity to put you in what felt like an unwinnable scenario. I don't know if there was any logic in there that meant that it was always going to be possible to reach where you were going, but certainly put you in a position that meant it was practically... It could be practically impossible to actually get to the start of the game, which is finding your ship. Which is it really had the capacity to put people off very early on. And compared that to, I don't know if you've played No Man's Sky since they've added onboarding.
I literally played it today. I launched it and I had a save file that had 8 minutes on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is pretty much just goes to show how much and little information I was giving right at the start to be able to actually proceed and play the game.
Mm-hmm.
Because usually I'll give a game 20 minutes, but 8 minutes is quite extreme for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think what happened with that, because this was like 2018, that save file was from, I was like, ooh, okay, well, we'll give it another go. Got really motion sick and had to stop, but enjoyed my time with it now, because it does lead you through. You know, you need to get this and it's over here, and then you need to get this, it's over here, and then you need to go to your ship and your ship needs this. And it does it well without overloading you with information right at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the onboarding now, every time I do it, is that I know what I'm expecting now when I start a new game, say, from No Man's Sky. But it is interesting to see, especially that I imagine originally the game design perspective on it was, well, we're creating this world where anything, this game where anything could happen, and you could be anywhere at any time. So that should be part of the onboarding, is that you're just thrown in to a wilderness and you see what you get out, which makes sense from a design perspective, but not from a playability perspective. The moment you give that to a player, they're like, but I don't know what to do and I'm stuck.
Yeah.
And actually going, okay, we'll give you that random planet, that random whatever, but we will set some of the conditions so that, you know, your ship is within walking distance and the items that you need are in these places, and the places you need to go are not so far away, and we'll still challenge you. Because there's a bit in the onboarding, this is not spoilers, if there's a bit in the onboarding where you have to get a particular item, and to get there, you're basically going to have to walk a couple of minutes to get there. And you will always encounter a storm of some kind that basically puts you in a bit of danger. And so while you're getting there, you're like, am I going to make it? Do I need to find some cover? What am I going to do? And you do make it. It's just about enough that you can get it without dying. And once you've got to the place, there's cover and a building and you're fine. But what was interesting is that I started a new game with my partner on her planet when she was already into it. So she'd done the onboarding. So we were in the same place at the same time. And I had a storm as the onboarding new player, and she did not. And so it was interesting to go, they are specifically targeting me with this technique to get me into the game, which is great, because that's what you want. Mm. You want that kind of guided experience that feels like you're just taking part in the game, but actually is teaching the mechanics. Same as Skyrim, same as Mario games, same as all these kind of things. And what was there before, made, while it was consistent with the story, you're thrown in and just there you go, actually put me and probably other people off because you're going, I don't know what I'm doing. And nothing is, there's either, the two worst things for an onboarding is either confusion, you put people in a position where they don't get it, or being so extended that a person gets to the point where they're like, I'm ready to start the game now, and the game's still taking it at like a tenth of the speed of the actual game because it's trying to get you set up and ready to go.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, were, like, in game dev, the hardest thing to get right is probably the difficulty curve with anything. I would say VR is harder because you don't really have a target audience. There isn't the market research out there to know who your target audience is. You can assume, but you might not be correct. Especially with what we do at Fennec Labs, which is we do commercial VR, so we do VR arcades and that sort of thing. So, like, my Joe Public, my lowest common denominator is like grandma from down the street. I need to make sure that grandma can enjoy it, but also her grandson, who is hyper techy, he has a headset at home, you know, he's got 4,000 hours on Beat Saber. I need to make sure that both those people can enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why, for me, onboarding is really, really important. Because I need to make sure that everyone understands it, not just, you know, people my age.
And this is one of the flaws of onboarding. And there's the famous example of Super Meat Boy, where a player didn't get it because they didn't understand. I think it was they didn't understand the concept of double jump or quite how it sort of how to pull it off. And although it exploded into a whole argument between developers and journalists and all that kind of thing, we'll put that to one side for a minute. The point was is that if there is a fundamental part of a game that a person who is not attuned with that your particular style of game doesn't get, that the fault of that lies with either the marketing because you haven't pitched the game to the right people, so somebody who is not being pitched for is playing it, or with you as a developer because you've not quite figured out how to introduce that to somebody who doesn't get it. Like, if you're building a platforming game, but it's explicitly for people who have played 1,000 platformers before, then sure. But that has to come across in your marketing. If you're pitching a platforming game for people who like games or are interested in what you're doing, the lore, the mechanics, whatever, then you have to accept that you'll get people who've played every platforming game under the sun, but you'll also be someone's first ever platforming game, but they've never played before, and they need and exactly as you said, you need to be able to cater for both of them, and especially when it comes to VR, and especially when it comes to, you know, just in general, VR games as well as more commercial VR, which we also do over at Betajester, that it's the fact that you're going to come across people who have either never taken part in VR or don't like the technology, or have played lots of games and not VR, because that's also difficult because they're so trained into certain ways of playing a certain game, especially if you're doing something novel, which for VR you just are by definition. But if you're making a game that has some kind of novel movement technique which is different to what a player expects, you have to not only train them in what they're going to do but also untrain them in what they expect. So a good example of this is that in VR, for example, the player, somebody who's played a lot of video games may walk up to a door and expect there to be some kind of key prompt for the door to open. The fact that they physically have to put their hand on the handle and turn the handle so that the lock unlocks and then open the door is not necessarily something that every player is going to expect. So you have to think about, how do I introduce that to someone? Now, the good thing is, that's how we open doors in real life. So a player anticipating a real life response should theoretically go up and try that, but you still have to on that board that player in grabbing things, in pressing things, in the fact that the mechanics of real life are here, not the mechanics of a video game. And that's quite a difficult thing to sort of introduce to people.
Yeah, it is really hard, and especially if you're dealing with controllers versus hand tracking, for example. Hand tracking you can get away with a lot more because people sort of can have that disconnect from gaming because you're not actually holding a physical controller, you are the controller. As corny as that is, it is true. So people can reach for things, they'll pick them up and they go, oh, okay, well, that's kind of cool. And also a brilliant way to onboard people in VR, if you have hand tracking, is to just give them toys. because as soon as you put anyone in VR for the first time, first thing they do is pick everything up, throw stuff around, and that's, you know, they're mesmerized by it. Even, you know, people who have hundreds of thousands of hours in regular games will go into VR and be like, oh, this is fun. I'm grabbing this and I'm throwing it over there and it's doing it. And they get that mysticism and the enjoyment and the pure joy that comes with it. But if you add controllers into it, you have to do the prompt still. You have to say, okay, it's trigger to grab or it's A to grab, depending on who, what you're doing and, you know, who you are. Personally, I like trigger to grab because it's more of that tactile nature, which I think is really important for onboarding in VR, is making everything tactile rather than expecting people to know that A is jump.
And VR brings its own problems anyway, the fact that every the controller is differently shaped. We have a little bit of homogeneity now, but even then, it's still not perfect. And obviously, like you said, the difference between somebody who's using hand tracking, so they just have their own physical hands in the space, versus somebody who is using a Quest or using some other controller. You have to try and anticipate different people coming into it from different walks of life. And an example of this actually that came to mind is a good game that did an interesting thing in terms of that kind of, how do you set up somebody for what's going to happen? Which is a big part of onboarding, is, you know, it's not only teaching people that this is how you play, but this also in terms of physically doing something, this is how you play in terms of how the game's going to try and play you back. The game Superhot, which was first a first-person shooter, and then it became a first-person shooter again, but now in VR, has this wonderful level very early on where you're into the game basically works on it's a first-person shooter. You pick up weapons and you shoot people with them. But the core of the mechanic is, and if you listen to this podcast, you've heard me gush about Superhot before, is time only moves when you move. So if you stand still, nothing happens. And one of the first couple of levels involves you picking up a gun or a weapon and shooting somebody or hitting them over the head, and that introduces you to pick up, you know, do damage to person explodes and everything's great. However, about the third or fourth level is you at the end of a corridor with one to three people aiming at you at the other end of the corridor, shooting bullets at you. You have no way of reaching, of interacting with them. You have no gun. You have no items that you can throw. And throwing's a whole different thing in VR anyway. So you have to make your way down the corridor. And the only way to do that in both game and VR is to think very carefully about the mechanic. Time will only move when I move. So every second is you tactically going, okay, well, if I kind of duck down, that bullet's going to come towards me. But if I can get low enough, I'll get underneath it. And then I can keep moving and da-da-da-da-da. And that level brings in this concept, it really drills into you the idea that time is only going to move when you move. You can walk down a corridor full of bullets as long as you do it slowly and carefully and stop when you need to stop and think about it. And that's why people often describe Superhot not as a first-person shooter, but as a puzzle game. Because it's actually about logicking out how do you move through this level so that you aren't accidentally shot by someone. In a traditional game, if you were playing, I don't know, Doom, for example, and you had to just run down a corridor and there's just three people at the other end shooting you and there's nowhere to move in the corridor, you just get shot and die. That's the end of the game. So Superhot has to unteach you that. It's not, and teach you, don't just run down the corridor. That will not work, and teach you how to play itself. And when it comes to VR especially, that's doubly important because you're just a person in a corridor with a kind of supernatural power, or super hot power, if you will. And you have to kind of realize that that's how you're going to approach the scenario, and the game has to force you into that.
Yeah. I think one of the big things of VR is you have to force people to do exactly what you want them to do. And that's a whole other thing, like behind design, I'm not going to get overly into it, but in onboarding, it is a matter of you put someone in a dark room, you light up a button so that they will go and press the button. Because you will get the 2 in 100 players who won't go and press the button. They'll go completely the opposite way just to be annoying, but that's on them.
I think
to, you know, not complete the objective, not actually progress.
Yeah. That's a very, you brought up a very important point there, which is that one thing that a lot of people get really stuck on is, well, what happens if they don't? And particularly important in VR, because people can do whatever you want. But what happens if the person doesn't want to do the thing that I'm telling them to do? And some games will just hard fast lock you into, well, this is what you're doing. There you go. That's it. No alternatives. But other games won't. And to go back to your example of Skyrim, for example. So Skyrim, you basically don't have an option from the beginning. You have to follow this kind of linear path. You go through a series of small rooms until you get to the end. But once you get outside the end of the sort of the initial onboarding, you're set up to do something. You're set up to go to Whiterun and speak to some people and set up the whole quest about you being a Dragonborn and But you don't have to. And a lot of people don't. A lot of people, the game says go right, they go left, and they run off. There are people who play Skyrim to pretend to be one of the guards in one of the cities, and all they do is just wander around the city, talk to people. That is a thing that happens, right? And some people play 400 hours of the game before going to the first place, which is literally you come out of the beginning and it's right in front of you, where you get like your initial stat boost. They just wander off in a different direction, don't even notice it's there. And that's the point. It's about you kind of have to accept that there are things that you're going to want to teach people, but you also have to accept that a lot of players are just going to screw around and they're not going to care. And the thing for me with video games is that, and VR especially, is that you're trying to bring the player into your world, into the thing that you're creating. And if that player doesn't, you have to accept that that person wants to do that. Because if that person doesn't want to do that, you can't convince them. There's nothing you can do. If they're not willing to suspend their disbelief, it's not going to happen. Great example of this in VR is if the first thing they do is try and smash their head for a wall, that person is already going, I want to break your system very, very quickly. Now, I'm not saying, therefore, don't do anything to that. You know, definitely have things like, if someone tries to stick their head through a wall, fade their eyes to black and do these kind of things. And there's all these kind of compensations out there. But it's important not to get too lost in trying to handle every possible use case of a player, because then all you'll be doing is building onboarding and never actually build the game itself.
Yeah. And I think that's like especially important because we do like experiences. So we'll do, 40 minutes of this particular thing. And what we've done recently is it's about 8 rooms and you go from room to room completing tasks, doing puzzles, picking up things and stuff like that. And one of the first questions that the client had was, okay, but how do we make them do that? And you go, well, that's not on me. That's on you. That's on the storyteller. I'm here to make the game. I'm here to make the experience. I'm not here to tell the, you have quite often operators who will, if someone's got particularly stuck, like in an escape room is a really good example. They always have mechanisms where they can give you hints, be it via speaker, via screen, something like that. And that is a must have for experiences versus games in VR LBE, because I can't program for every eventuality in a game. I can't design for every eventuality. I just need to make it obvious enough that this key goes in that hole and that opens the door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and talking about the sort of learning based environments, like that's essentially what the onboarding is. It's putting you it's to teach you the key things that you need. You will probably learn more going into the rest of the game, but that's where you start and that's where you learn it. And a great example to your point about how do we stop doing it? You don't. Is think about a non-digital technology, right? Think about books, right?
Yeah.
Nothing is stopping someone from opening that book halfway through or on the last page, or doing anything that messes around with how the book is designed to be read, right? Which is from the beginning all the way through until the end, depending on your context, right to left or left to right. But nothing actually can physically stop it. The book, if you open it, it's not like the pages are going to be blank and you have to go through each page to unlock the next page. It doesn't do anything to stop you because it has to trust that the person who is reading it wants to read the story in the manner that it was designed to be read from the beginning until the end. And games are often like that, is that you have to accept that, depending on the style of game that you're going for, that you get people who are going to do chaotic things. But, and like I said, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't prepare for that. And this is where onboarding and testing come into mind, is that playtesting your onboarding is vitally important. This is why you see, for example, a lot of games at expos, is because they're taking an early version of the game to put it to people in a scenario like an expo scenario is great because each person is going to be there for 5, maybe 10 minutes, will do the beginning of your game, and then will leave, right? So you're just going to get loads of feedback on that specific bit, because you find flaws in your game very, very quickly when somebody only has five. You have to drag them into paying attention to the game. If your onboarding isn't really tight, then they'll just bounce off it, or they'll find the problem, a flaw with it. And one of my favorite examples of this, of finding a flaw, is a VR game, which is that there was a, I can't remember what it was called, but it was basically a card game, like a casino. And it had a like a blackjack table. So you playing the dealer, and the dealer puts down their cards face down. They deal your cards and da da da. And the person in VR, traditional game, great. There you go. Press X A on your cards. Wonderful. Person in VR put their head under the table and looked up, and it didn't render the table underneath, and they could see the dealer's cards, and they could just see what it was. They're like, oh, great. And then they played against what they could see. Which is just a hilarious flaw that doesn't really, you wouldn't think of in real life, but also, like, because in real life, if you tried to pick up the dealer's cards, you'd just be kicked out of the casino. But the fact that the person who originally made that hadn't thought of, well, what would a player do? If a player has the freedom in a gambling game to go and look at the cards, they will just do that. They'll try and break it. And, they could have tried to pick up the cards, they could have stuck their face in it, they could have done loads of stuff. So the fact that the person hadn't considered that is because they hadn't tested what users will do in the environment. And that's also a big part of onboarding, is going, what are users going to do? Where do they struggle? What's the issue? Where in my game are they going to find a problem? And that's a really important part of it.
I think as a developer, it's very easy to go blind to things like that, because you've seen it a billion times because you've tested it for bugs, but you don't test it specifically for UX because you're familiar with it. You know how everything works. You know how the first puzzle is completed. You know how the first battle goes. And it's so, so important to have those outsiders come in and look at it and go, okay, but I could do this. And, the door opens or the enemy dies. And it's so important to make sure that what you're doing makes sense to other people.
Yep.
Because half the time it will not. And you can give it to developer friends and it will make sense to them. But you give it to Joe Public and they go, I have no idea what's happening.
This is why events, expos, as we move back into sort of attending things physically, playtesting events, even just getting friends who aren't gamers, who play your type of games, and all these kind of people to test it as you're going through, helps you to stay grounded in what's important about your game. Because it's very easy to become so good at the game because you're playing it so constantly, and to understand all the menus, how quickly to get to the main game or whatever it might, or just skip all that altogether, that you lose track of that kind of importance. And a really interesting example of this, if not quite the losing it, is Splitgate. Is that if you watch the developers play Splitgate, they play the game in a totally different way to people who've just started playing it, because they play it by like pinging portals around the map and just sort of flicking between them very, very quickly and assassinating people just on a whim. Whereas if I play it, like, I use portals a bit, like I try and use them to get behind people and stuff like that, but I've got friends who just forget that they exist because they're so used to playing first-person shooters. And it would have been very easy for the developers to go, well, everyone will get it, and just jump in and get it, and have people bounce off the game because they didn't understand the fundamentals of it. Fortunately, it has that tutorial in there where it at the very least introduces that mechanic and makes sure you could do it. But I've definitely seen games that just kind of, they skip over that, and it's really important to have not only the win states, but also the fail states explained very early on, which takes me back to the very core example of onboarding, traditionally like held up as like the champion of onboarding, which is Super Mario Bros. 1-1, which is the very first game, the very first level of Mario Bros. The first thing that happens is you as Mario spawn in, an enemy is coming towards you. Nothing will stop that enemy coming towards you. You cannot run through the enemy because you die. You cannot run away from the enemy because he catches you. So you have to very quickly go, how do I get past this enemy? And you will press the only thing you can press, which are the buttons. And eventually you will press A and you will jump. And then you go, oh, I can jump over it. Great. And then you jump over it and you carry on. And very quickly you've learned the game is about jumping over things, jumping around things, moving and jumping. That's it. That's the core of the game. And yes, it goes on beyond there. And the next thing you get is a question block, and you hit that, and you find something, and you learn about what it means to jump on things. But right, the very first thing it does is put you in a fail state. You are going to lose the game if you don't do something at the beginning of Mario. And so you do something, and that doing something teaches you that by doing something you can succeed and get past and da-da-da-da. It's a good trick that then people try and replicate in other games and often doesn't work. But including the concept of failure is just as important. You can lose, you can mess things up, you can die and then you have to go back and do the thing again and all this kind of stuff. And that had how a lot of games sort of bring in the idea of onboarding, of going, we teach you how to play, but also what it means to play badly as well.
Yeah, I think that's where VR differs massively from conventional gaming, is because if you put those fail states in too often, people are going to get annoyed, because not only do you have to possibly, in some games, move back to a different area to restart that particular point, or you're having to just stay where you are, but you have the artificial locomotion or the Guardian system in Oculus, for example. But there's so many different variables in which, where literally you are positioned, can massively change how a scenario goes. So, for example, if you're in a first-person shooter, you might have a particular point in your room that is a spawn zone. And that is to make sure that when you start the game, you are in the center of your room.
Mm.
Because if it's a certain shooter that maybe you flail about a lot, then you don't want to be near any walls. You don't want to be near any objects. So there's a lot to consider with onboarding in VR games. A hell of a lot. I'd argue more than in conventional games, because there are too many variables within the games, and it's not established. So it's not established that A is jump, like in conventional games. It's not established that grip is to grip. It's very, very different still.
And especially in VR, it brings in human expectation. You expect things to react as you would expect in the real world, because you feel like you're playing in the real world, because your hands move like your hands and you move like you. So when things don't move like they do in the real world, or even when they do, and it's just in a way that you beyond what you expected, it really can throw people off. One of the classics is in a video game, if you fall off the side of the platform and fall forever, you hit a point and you die, and there you go, you restart. If you fall off in VR and have to fall infinitely into the void, it is weird. It's really odd as a developer to accidentally go the wrong way and just fall off the world and just watch the world leave you behind. You're just like, well, I've fallen forever now. And it's a really, really odd feeling to have. So you have to take that into account. Whereas in a video game, you don't have to worry about it, because you fall off, you restart, and there you go, it's fine. So yeah, dealing with human expectations of real life on top of game expectations as well is an extra complexity built in there. Plus also, people are used to a game physically, you know, hand-holding them and stepping them through the stages. Whereas in VR, people just expect that. A lot of people just go like, oh, I know what I'm doing now. And they're like, but why? You've never played this game before. You've never been in this scenario before. Why do you think you just understand this? And it's like, oh, because it's just like real life. And you're like, but it's not. You got the grip button, it's around the side of the controller. The number of people I've had to physically grab their hand, not in the last year and a half, I will say, grab their hand and sort of move it round the controller to where the grip button is to teach them how to press it. Because a lot of people just don't get the weirdness of trying to translate actual movement into something. Like, games makes no bones about the fact that it's not real, because it's a controller. It's designed to be visual, and you look at it and you get it, and da da da. VR tries to be real, and if you're not doing hand tracking, then people don't always get it.
Even if you are doing hand tracking, sometimes people don't get it, especially in location-based entertainment, where, you know, you could have anyone coming in, and you have to make sure that this person who's paying £40 for their experience is going to have a nice time. You need to figure out a way to make sure they know what they're doing. And a lot of the time, that is done outside of the game.
Yep.
So you'll have posters that say, okay, so the trigger button is your trigger for your gun or something like that. Or you'll get a splash screen in game, or you'll get a poster in game, something like that. Or what we do quite often is, while you're putting the kit on, so your headset, backpack, PC, whatever is the setup for this particular venue, there will be a video playing, audio playing that will bring you into the world, but also not too much so that they can't tell you that, okay, so this button does this on this controller. Because you can do the floating controller stuff, you can do all of that. But the problem is, when you're on a limited time scale and you're not someone's not playing it at home in their living room, you need to make sure that that information is given across as soon as possible, and that they can't just mess around and not go through that certain bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is exactly why, so if you try to play Superhot in VR, I don't know if it's still the case, but it used to be, it would always boot up and say, are you trying to play Superhot, or are you trying to show somebody Superhot? Because if you're trying to show someone Superhot, we'll change the entire demo and put on a slightly different version of it so that people can jump into really quickly. Because in VR, the pressures on the game to be explanatory are so much higher, especially when you're showing someone, you know, because not every VR game is as intuitive as something like, for example, Beat Saber, where Beat Saber is just wave your arms. There's no buttons, just wave your arms. It's fine. Whereas, you know, Budget Cuts or Sword and Sorcery? I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head. Sword and Blade? The fighting one.
Yeah.
Medieval fighting
game. It's Sword and Blade, isn't it? I know it's Sword and Sorcery, you are right.
That one. Just search all these terms in Steam and you'll find it. You have to learn, you learn about picking up, and you learn about movement, you learn about this and that and the other. A lot of these games, they have all these extra complexities that you're just not necessarily prepared for if you haven't thought about it beforehand. And if the game doesn't step you through it, right? Which is where my, again, one of my absolute favorite examples of VR games in general, but also of onboarding, is I Expect You to Die. Because the introductory sequence where I Expect You to Die, not only is it narrative friendly in that it plays out like the beginning music sequence of a Bond film, but it also introduces you to the mechanics of the fact that you're basically going to be playing several Bond films, and shows you the idea of this is what it's going to be like, this is, you know, this is how it's going to be, but without taking it so far as to get into the absolute complexities, because they will be custom to every kind of scenario. And really the key here is that what we're trying to get across is that if you don't think about the onboarding in your game and just like, here go, play, you have the capacity to make a bunch of people bounce off your game very, very quickly. And this exists at all levels. This doesn't matter if you're building a AAA game, if you're building a, you know, a game jam game, that if you don't have some kind of explanation of what is going on, and actually, to be honest, even more important in game jam games, because I've played enough game jam demos where the first thing I do is go, I have no idea what I'm doing. And that sets you off on a path of basically not being a big fan of the game that you're playing, because you don't get it, and you need to get it to get to be able to in, be, you know, to go along with the developer and what they're trying to explain to you, that it's important to have that element in there.
Yeah, especially with smaller games like game jam games and small factor games that are just basically, my favorite examples are always social issue games. So you go onto itch.io and you get, you know, a billion different games, oftentimes they're visual novels, quite often they're not though, and it will be on an issue like LGBTQ issues and stuff like that, and I love those, but I don't like it when I get to the game, the download page, I download the game, go to play it, and then have to go back to the download page to learn the controls, because it isn't explained anywhere in game.
Yeah, like having to read the manual for video games is something that happened 20 years ago. Like, we're at the point now, even if it's just, even if, and you know, some games still just do, well, here's the control scheme, there you go. At least if that's in-game, then you've got some, you don't have to go back to the page. But honestly, like, if you can just spend some of the time setting up, even a level that's just like, okay, press this button, then this button, then this button, then this button, and it just introduces you to the basics of what you're doing, that is going to be way better than just hoping that people just intuitively understand what's going on. And the thing is, and this is across the board of all games, VR and otherwise, if somebody plays it for 5 minutes and still doesn't get what they're doing, it's going to take a lot of reasoning for them to continue wanting to play, especially today with things like Game Pass and all that kind of stuff. It's a entertainment, it's an entertainment game now, in that so much that you have to capture someone and they go, oh yeah, I really get it. The only time that doesn't happen is if you win like Game of the Year and then people go, okay, there's a reason for me to push past the first 10 minutes of not very good onboarding. And that really is only going to go to one game a year. So you really have to be going, how do I make sure that this person who I don't know anything about and I can't know anything about gets my game quickly enough that they want to keep playing it? Because if they don't, they'll bounce off and they won't play it. And this is where all the stuff that we talked about, taking it to events, getting friends to play it who don't play a lot of video games, getting friends who do play video games, constantly testing and trying and figuring it out. And more importantly, having it there in the first place is really, really important for the long-term success of your game.
Yeah, I quite often ask my dad to try things because parents, he's not great. A gamer.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Because most people's parents aren't gamers at all, And my dad used to play Super Mario 1. No, not Super Mario, sorry, just Mario. Mario Brothers 1 on the NES, because my brother would get stuck and he would have to play the level for him because my brother was too little to understand. But that is the limit of my dad's gaming. So occasionally I'll go, okay, well, I'm not entirely sure how this onboarding is going to go. I will ask him to go for it. Because he definitely doesn't do VR, let alone gaming. So knowing that he can get through it means that I've hit it and it's okay.
The moral of the story here is, if your parents can play your game, most other people could probably play your game as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have any other thing that you want to say to people about onboarding, Vix?
Don't be afraid of it, and don't be afraid to actually have it completely separate even from your game. So have it like a dream sequence at the start or something like that is a very good way of actually introducing all the mechanics you need, but you might not necessarily need right away.
Yeah, 100% with that.
A good way to separate it from the main game flow. But it is essential.
It is essential. And I think if you take anything away from this, have a look at your game, have a think about how, if you were to give that to someone tomorrow, how are they going to get into it? How are they going to understand it? And more than anything, it doesn't matter if it's in there, if it's diegetic, if it just makes sense, or if it's a real hard, like, here it is in a gray box, do the things that I need you to know that you can do and then go on. It's better to have it than not have it, because it's better to have somebody do it and go, oh, okay, I get it now, and play your game, than somebody trying to understand your game, not get it, not like it, and never play it again, or worse, tell people that, it's a really hard game to get into, it doesn't really make any sense, and they put off other people.
Yeah, and I am guilty of doing that to games, and just going, I have no idea what's happening, so I wouldn't bother.
Oh yeah, I've been guilty of going, I didn't get this, and especially, like I said, doing game jams and stuff as a judge, you end up, if a game bounces off very quickly, then it's hard to give it more points, because even if there is a great game in there, because I didn't get into it very quickly, because I didn't put any time into trying to help me get there.
Yeah, it sours it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we don't want to. We don't want sour games. Sour candy?
No.
We can roll with. Sour games? Not great.
Games about sour candy?
Games about sour candy. If anybody after this episode comes up with a onboarding system for a game with sour candy, please send it to us at hello@gamedev.london. We want to play your sour game. But I think that's strange, slightly strange bombshell is a good place to leave it. So I just wanted to say thank you very much, Vix, for joining us on this episode. And if you out there enjoyed this episode as well, then you can go to all the usual places, leave us with a 5-star review. Come and tell us what you liked about this episode. Come and join our Discord. We've got a community of 1300 something developers at this point. You can join us by going to gamedev.london/join. You can find more about us by going to gamedev.london, where you can find links to this episode and all our previous episodes, as well as all the things that we do and our events and that kind of thing. But other than that, it just leaves me to say thank you for watching this episode, and we'll see you here same time next week. Bye.